Hi, welcome back to Computer Science E75. This is week 6. My name is Siddharth, and today we will be doing JavaScript and a little bit of PHP. So let's just start off by looking at this Bexford project 2. Hope that's going well. If you have any questions, email it at help@cs75. Hopefully we can do a little bit of PHP that's relevant to the project, some JavaScript, and possibly come back and sort of go over the entire project. But to begin with, let's take a look at the fourth requirement on the PDF. So it says, your site must pull its real-time data, so price of the stocks that you show, from Yahoo Finance by parsing its CSVs. So, and it links to the fget.csv page to the function, the PHP function to parse CSVs to help you out. So let's just start off by doing a little bit of CSV sort of parsing, getting data out, storing it in different places, etc. So CSV stands for comma-separated values. So CSV, a CSV file is basically a list of comma-separated values. So it's just different. This is an example of a CSV file. So it just has some random data. It looks like a name, an age, a school, and some concentration, so a major. There are three lines in it, so this is the entire CSV file. And we'll just go over different ways of parsing it and sort of extracting data from it. So the very first time we do this, let me just pull up another copy of this. Okay, so the very first page looks like we're just printing everything that's in an array. If you've tried this before, if you just try print r for a given object in PHP, you might have seen this sort of format of printing stuff out. And that is exactly what I'm doing here. So I open the file, so I have a handle, so a file handle. And once I open it, I use the function fget.csv. So let's pull it up, see how it works, and then we can go over it in a little bit more detail. So fget.csv returns an array. That's the first thing to note. So even if you have only one line, there are no commas in your page, it will return an array of one element. So fget.csv returns a handle, takes a handle, so a file opening. So you open a file, you have a handler for that file, and you pass it to fget.csv. It takes a length, so up to how many characters are you going to accept. Note that the length is an optional parameter. So the square brackets in the documentation denotes that you're not required to give it in, but it is okay. And the delimiter, so dollar delimiter, is by default a comma as indicated, but again, very optional. So if you don't give it anything, it'll just split it in terms of commas, which in this case is exactly what we want. So here I'm still filling it in for, so it's just fget.csv handle up to 1,000 characters. That's just an arbitrary limit that I place. And give a comma. So while this is not false, so while there is some information in the file, just repeatedly just dump the data. And when we take a look at there's an array of four elements, just prints it out multiple times. Simple example. Any questions so far? I'm sorry? What was it?
So if there were 4,000, that's what it would
dump. If there's 4,000?
So there are four arrays. And if there are 4,000 arrays.
Yeah, yeah. So it doesn't matter. The question is how many arrays. It doesn't matter at all. Because I'm just recursively looking. I'm just repeatedly looking through the file. So I'm just getting, as long as I can fget.csv return something, I'm good. So I'll just keep print every one of it out. OK, so number two is a little better, not too much, but it seems like I've extracted some useful information out of this CSV. So I'm saying the student's name is Sid, the student's name is Fu, and the student's name is Bar. Let me just pull up the CSV again so that sounds right. So it's just the three lines, and I'm just printing it out. So let's take a look at the source for this file. It's a little bigger. There we go. First. The same idea. So store fget.csv in data. So as a reminder, fget.csv returns an array. So store that in variable, the dollar data variable. And once I do that, I just print out the first element of the array. So it's an array with the elements just stored as in the CSV file. So when I store this in array, the first array of 0 is Sid, array of 1 is 18, et cetera, et cetera. So here all I'm doing is just saying print out the first element, so data of 0, and that just gives me the name on the line. Is that clear? Cool. So the next one. This is much better. So it's like a nice print line in there. I'm printing out the name, the age, and whatever the major is, which again should be fairly straightforward based on this example. So you start off by storing it in variable data, and once you store it, just print the first. So if we look at the CSV file, you see that the first one is the name, the second is the age. So here I'm just saying student name, age, studies, whatever, which is in this case is the last element, so it's data of 3, and then at school, which is data of 2. And once I print that out, I print a break line just to format it, and it looks through it. Clear so far? Questions? Great. So the fourth example is probably the most interesting and useful. Okay, so this looks like the details of a stock. So Goog is the ticker for Google. There's some information here. I'm not sure what exactly it is. So let's take a look at the actual code and then go from there. So fopennow no longer takes a local file in my folder. It in fact takes a URL. So this is something that's very useful. So when you fopen, you need not just store a CSV in your local sort of folder or directory and give that the file, but in fact just open URLs as open web pages as if they're just files, and which is great. So let's actually pull this URL up and see what it gives us. So when I just entered that in the browser, I get back a CSV file as I expected. So what this does is just opens the file that it returns without having to go through sort of downloading it yourself. So once I do that, I just get CSV and then print the data. So how is this relevant to Project 2? This is exactly what you want to do. So you want to get, first you have a form where the user asks enters whatever stock ticker he wants, stock symbol, I guess, he wants prices for. Once you do that, you have to just query the appropriate URLs, which would mean changing this parameter S to whatever symbol you want, and then just looking at the way the CSV file is arranged and printing the appropriate details out. Questions?
One thing I noticed when using that is, regardless of whether the symbol is correct, meaning that it's an actual stock, still get something back.
Yep. So the comment was that regardless of whether the symbol actually exists, it in fact will give you back. So when I do that, for instance, I just entered some random symbol. It still gives me back a CSV. So you have to also be clear that like the details that you get back, it's taking a while to open, but you have to just be clear that whatever you get back, you have to defensively check to make sure that there is in fact some value in whatever you just got back. So if you look at this, it's just like there's a 0. So the first is the symbol that I just entered. There's no price. There's nothing available. So just sort of being aware that this is a possible case and checking defensively for it and making sure that there actually exists certain values in these fields is a useful thing. Other questions, comments? Great. OK, so let's do some JavaScript. Before we start off, just to show you sort of what is possible with JavaScript, there's this website called Cornify, which boasts that it provides unicorns and rainbows on demand. So when you click the button, it populates the page with pictures of unicorns, rainbows, and other glittery substances. This is all JavaScript, so it is all server-side. So this is a great introduction to sort of what JavaScript is and is not. Sorry, client-side, my bad, sorry. It's all client-side. So this is a great introduction to what JavaScript is sort of capable and is not. When you... anything that is done on this page is just on my sort of version of the page. So any changes that I make, when I go back to the site even for instance, all of that is lost. So JavaScript is entirely client-side. It's possible, and this is something that we will go over when we go through the examples, it is possible to sort of override any client-side validation that you provide. So this is something I'll stress again, like I said, but it is just important to keep in mind that JavaScript validation, which is a requirement in Project 2. So I believe I can't find this here, but just be aware that validating with JavaScript is not necessarily going to fill everything you need. So let's get started on some validation, go over some stuff. So I'm going to start with base.php, right? So I'm going to say at foobar.com, anscool is ASDF, so I'm going to hit add. So that looks like it did nothing. So it's just a form. It's nothing more to it. So if you take a look at the source, it submits nowhere. So obviously, like when I entered details, nothing really happened. It's just a form. It's just a basic form with this table, which we don't really use so far, but it's something that we will use very soon. It's just a table with the ID student table. So let's get started with the first one. Let's pull this up. Okay. So table manipulation. So let's do this again. Okay. So that did something. So basically, I entered some information, and it basically printed it out at the bottom of the screen. Keep in mind that no request was made here. So clearly, whatever I did, just by seeing the lag, sort of lack of lag when I submitted the form. Sort of indicates that there's no request, so there's no PHP sort of submitting to another PHP page and processing going on. Let's take a look at the source. Let me actually just pull up the source on this page. Okay, so and before we do that, so I'm going to add another field, but this time I didn't fill in some of the details. So, and immediately it sort of marked all the columns with red, whichever I didn't fill out. So I'm going to change some stuff, hit add again. And clearly, this was right, but the email again was wrong because email was not of a valid format. So let's do, and that worked. So all of this validation is happening on the client side with JavaScript. So let's start with the source. So this is the less interesting part of the file. It's just a form. It submits to itself, so there's nothing going on there. But there's this sort of attribute that you've seen in lecture, but not yet in section. It says on submit attribute. Just like it says, what it does is on submitting, it returns you can specify JavaScript there. So in this case, you're just saying on submit return this function called check submission. We'll go over what check submission does, but it's a function that I've defined. It just says return check submission on submitting. So the moment somebody hits submit, don't pass this to any form. All you do is do this. So. And this the student table still exists, and that's also something we will see very soon. Okay, so let's begin with the very very top. So far, any questions? Okay. So to begin with, JavaScript, when you write JavaScript within a file itself and not sort of include a file from outside, you have to start with the script type equals JavaScript. So this is very similar to CSS, where you would say type equals text/css. So you have the JavaScript, and I'm defining a function check submission. For those of you who are familiar with PHP functions or functions in any other language, really, the syntax should be pretty familiar. So you have I'm defining a function that has the name check submission. It doesn't take any arguments because we're not passing anything clearly. It defines a variable user input equals true. So the first thing in JavaScript is that you need to declare your variables with the keyword var. So variable user input, I'm setting that to true. So the first thing I do is check to see. So let's go back to the source of this file. So if you take a look at the individual like sort of fields in the form. There are all these fields that say ID equals student span, ID equals email span, school span, etc. So basically, I'm giving each of the fields a unique ID. And it's all enclosed within spans, which we will see sort of how it's useful in a second. So here we're saying document.myForm.student.value equals equals zero. So there's a lot going on in this one line. So let's begin with the first part. So document. Document, as the name specifies, just refers to the document that you're on. So best just the entire document of that page. And then it says .myForm. So let's go back to the source of the form. If you look at the name of this form, it says name equals myForm. So when you have an element in your HTML that is given a specific name, you can access it by saying document dot that name, or whatever the hierarchy is. So document dot myForm dot student. So let's take a look at what student is. And student happens to be this field right here. So it says type equals text, which is just a text field, but the ID is specified as just student. So when I say document.myForm.student, all I'm referring to is document. Give me the form in document, and within this myForm, get me the text field that is called student. Once I have this, I'm checking to see if value. So when you define a text field, for instance, I'm sure you're familiar with this, but if you want to give it a default serve text in the field that you use the value attribute in your input tag. So you would say input name equals something and value equals something. Value just refers to the actual value of the text box. So when I hit submit, does the value of this text box have anything at all? And if it is empty, document.getElementById, we'll come back to that in a second, but so far, any questions in sort of accessing the text field itself? Clear? So I'm going from document to my form to the field.
If you had a default value, would it actually show up in the field, or it would just be submitted if it doesn't?
So if you had a default value, would it show up in the field? It would. So if you have like a default value, if you specify in your HTML that value equals something, it will actually count as like the value of the text field. So in that case, if you sort of want something there, but you don't want to, you want to make sure people are still entering something, you could just check to see the value is the same as what you sort of initialized it with. And if it is, you know that it's not true. So that's instead of checking for blank, but that's just an alternative method.
If you're going to use the IDs anyway, do you need to use the document.myForm.student, or
can't
you just use...
Right. The question is, if you're going to use IDs, do you need to go document.myForm? Not at all. Like, it's great if you just want to pick one sort of method and use it, and that's completely acceptable, and there are different ways you can go about it. I just want to showcase the different like functions that you can use. So the if condition basically checks, and if is just like PHP, it just checks to see if the value of that text field is empty. And if it is empty, it says document.getElementById. And as the name suggests, what it does, it says, give me the element. Keep in mind that IDs in HTML have to be unique. So it says, give me the element that has, in the document, that has the ID student span. And as we saw in the source, student span is just the span sort of wrapping around the text field itself. Excuse me. So it's not the text field itself, but just the name of the text field. So in this case, it's a student name, as this says. So it's a student name, whatever. So it says, let me close that. Okay. So it says get element by ID. So give me back that element in the document that has the ID student span, which is just the text that each of the fields have, and set the color to red. So Whenever I sort of see that the text box is empty, just tell them that you have not filled this out, and just denote it by having that have a color, and then focus on that form. So basically, focus on that field. So focus, if for instance when you've tried signing into, for instance, Gmail, when you sign in with a wrong password, if you've noticed, it will put the cursor back on the password field and let you sort of enter from there instead of having to re-enter instead of like being outside. So for instance, this box right now is not focused where that is focused. So just like having, I think the camera missed it, so I'm just going to do that again. So this box is not focused, and this is. So just the cursor being within that text field. So it says just focus, just set focus to that form, and then set user input equals false. We'll go over this again. We can just come back to this. So keep in mind that we declared user input with the variable true to begin with. So it's just a Boolean that we're using as a flag of sorts. So we're saying, at the very beginning, set this to true. But if something goes wrong, we'll just set it to false. And at the very end, we can just see if things have gone wrong, and then we can go from there. So once that is done, we're first declaring this this regular expression with this string. So let's do a little bit of regular expressions before we go on. So regular expressions are basically very, very powerful tools, and it is very worthwhile going over, just looking up tutorials on them. I believe W3 Schools has a very good tutorial on them. Regular expressions are basically ways for you to specify patterns and grab and see if a given text, like, so for instance, an email, matches that pattern. So sort of intuitively, you can think about this as saying, is something of the form foo at bar.baz. So regular expressions just provides you with a tool to sort of make this possible and provide a certain framework in which you can check to see if given sort of input fits it. So the input validation here says, so we'll come back to this in a second, but we're saying, so this is the regex. So we're just saying this is the regular expression that we're going to use, and I can go into that briefly for how that works. But what happens? But what I say here is that I'm saying user input is false. So again, if this form value is empty, so if the email field, first we checked the name field, but now we're checking the email field, we're seeing if that's empty. If it is empty, we're just saying set user input to false, do the same thing as we did before. So first make that red and then focus it on that field. Once that is done, so the first condition is have they entered anything at all? The second condition is if they have entered something, have they entered the right sort of format? So let's take a look at this and let's just try that. So that didn't work, so email is still wrong. So let's now try that. So that's somehow validated. So clearly, so this is still an invalid regex, and part of the challenge is for you to write your own regex because it's a very useful exercise. But it looks like this is the general pattern we're going for. And now let's take a look at the actual regex. So it says, so regexes and expressions in general are sort of enclosed within slashes. So you have, so that's the outside slash. So you're just saying this is the pattern that I'm going to give you. So first is a dot. So this is what we, I believe we have. So this is, let's see. Okay. So there are three parts to this. So let's just break them down. So once you sort of see, this will become much more intuitive once you handle a few regexes and sort of write your own. But this basically has three parts. So I'm just going to indicate that here. So the dot in a regex basically indicates any character. So it just says whatever character you give me. The plus indicates that there should be at least one of it. So you're saying that there should be at least one character in there. So if I have, for instance, just at something, it's a wrong. It doesn't fit this pattern. So what we're saying is, there is some character, and there's at least one character. So the plus, so there are two operators here. So I could say dot star. This indicates that there is either zero or any number of characters, whereas this indicates that there should be at least one character there. Is that clear? So there should be at least one of some character, and then an at symbol. So this is a literal thing. So this is literally just checks for the at symbol. And then checks to see if the same thing happens on the other side. So if it does, just say it's a valid pattern. Definitely does not bring out the sort of powerful. There have been entire books that have been written on regular expressions. So it's definitely worthwhile to go over a couple of tutorials and figure out, write your own regexes to begin with. So that's just the pattern. That's the frame we're giving them. Sorry, question.
Yeah, if one writes a regex for the server side, what's the likelihood of being able to take that regex and just implementing the same one on the client side?
Sure. I'm not sure whether you, the question was, do you mean server side and client side or PHP and JavaScript?
Yes.
Okay. So what he's, the question was, if you have a regex in PHP, what are the chances of being able to use it in JavaScript? I'm not entirely sure of the exact implementation, but in general, regexes are sort of work across many languages. So it's the same idea. The pattern is probably the same, and it's not sort of language specific. It works across languages. And I believe this is the name of the function in PHP. Yep. So preg match basically says just perform a regular expression match. So preg match. And the regexes that you would use here are the same that you would use in JavaScript. So if you take a look at this, this just says not DE, but not D, but E or F. So it's the same patterns that will work across different languages.
So if I follow this, this is just a really crude way of checking to see if something is in the form of somebody adds somebody.
Sure.
But it's not really highly precise way of checking.
So the question was, go on. Right. So the comment was that this is a sort of crude way to check to see if people match the pattern. Regexes are entirely syntactic, so you usually don't check semantics with them. It's possible, but in general, it's more syntax, just like matching the sort of given structure. But I would argue that they're very, very elegant, just because of the sort of things you can do. You can specify how many. So if you were to write an actual regex for an email. Address, you could specify anything up to like how many characters that last. It could either be two or three characters, right? So it can be .com or .something else, and you can specify how many like sort of subdomains you can give people, so they can say something.co.something, and all of this is possible with just different regexes. So it does not match. You can't check. For instance, you can, but it's not gonna. If you want to check specifically for Gmail, you could do something like plus. At gmail.com, and this is a valid regular expression. This is right, but in general, you don't check semantics; you just check structure. Other questions? Okay, great. So now with that regex, we see this sort of called a test, which, as might be clear, just checks to see if a given input string. Matches the given regex, the regex that you specified. In this case, was a string. So it says if it does not match it. Once again, just do the same thing again. So just set that to like red. Make focus in on that field. Set user input to false. Once that's done, So there are two lines of code that I missed, but we'll come back to it. The third is just, did you leave the school field blank? Again, repeats the same idea. You check a bunch of things, and then you say, if all our checks pass, so if any of our checks failed, we just set user input to false. At the very beginning, user input was true. For each of the checks, we said, if this fails, set user input to false. If this fails, you set user input to false, and so on. So at any point of our checks, if the validation had failed, we would have set that variable to false. So now we're just checking to see if that didn't happen. So if that didn't happen, call this function called addEntry and return from the function. High level questions so far, or specific code level questions too. All clear? So there's one subtle thing here. So let's first kill this. Well, let's just enter some wrong email and let's hit enter, and it set the email to red. Right, so now I'm going to go ahead and enter a right email, and it changed email to black. So, so how does this happen? This just checks in here. So, if this thing failed, do all of that. But if none of that failed, just get element by ID, just the same thing, but set it to black. So, basically, if you'd submitted something wrong in the past, but now you've corrected it, it'll just not print that red anymore, and it'll just change it. So, and the same way I do that for every one of the other fields, so that when people just correct their mistakes, it does not display it anymore. Questions? Sweet. So let's take a look at what addEntry does. Just as a reminder, so when we did foobarbaz and hit enter, okay, so that's what it does. It basically, it looks like a table, right? Like the way it's formatted. Let's take a look at the source. this is a sort of subtle thing that makes things harder. So when you have JavaScript and you use JavaScript to sort of modify the page itself, the source itself does not change. So the source that you view. So now if you view the source, nowhere does it show us the table that was created right now. So it's still ID equals student table is just blank. So this is one of the reasons JavaScript is fairly hard to debug. So JavaScript debuggers in general are also hard to come by. But look for Firefox add-ons that help JavaScript debugging, and there are some very good ones. Okay, so let's take a look at add entry. So first, so we're storing the element by ID student table. Let me make this a little bigger, a little more. Okay, so student table, as we've seen already, is just this table that's just empty in the beginning, right? So it says store student table in this variable called myTable. Once you do that, so new row, so create element is another JavaScript function, which takes the name of the element you want to create. So here it's just tr. So tr in HTML, as we've seen, is just a new row within a table. So it just says create element tr. And then within that, it says create element td. So keep in mind that so right now we're not storing anything anywhere. We're just creating elements, right? And once we do that, we're saying append child. So we're creating a text node. And the reason this one is like slightly complicated and uses a lot of like random functions is just to show you what JavaScript is capable of. There is reasonably good documentation for each of these calls, so feel free to look them up and sort of figure out what exactly is going on. But roughly, what you have to recognize is that you create an element, so you create a tr and then a td. Once you create it, you append this child, and the child is a text node, which is just text for whatever submission was made. So document.myform.student.value just consists of whatever was in that text field when the person hit submit. So whatever was in there, just sort of append child, by which it's just create this sort of row and table and store it in there. Does that high level from a high level, is it clear? Sally, we don't have time to go into sort of individual syntax, so once again, just Google them and I'm sure you'll find great references. And do the same for the other ones too. So, so append child the email, append child the append child to the form again. And at the end of it, you have you've just created sort of a table structure with a TD and a TR and three sort of children in it. Let's go to the next example. So same thing. Okay, so it does the same thing. So let's take a look at the source. Let me just 1 second. Okay, so which one is this? This is table two. So let's just hit add. Okay, great. So if you look at this part of it, this is additional. So far we just did new row, append one, append child, which is what we did last time too. But after we append the children, append the entire new row to that table, so all of that's fine. Now clear the entries, right? So now when we do foobar baz and hit add, it just cleared those entries, and then it also did this weird highlighting thing. So it's just sort of more for what you can do with JavaScript. And the code for that, it says, it just at the end of all of this, after sort of clearing the form that you submitted in, it calls this function called highlight table. Let's take a look at what highlight table does. It just gets the element ID, so it's the first thing. And it says, iterate over the rows. So basically, now there's a new function that is, again, very useful. So this function is called getElementsByTagName. Just much like getElementById, getElementsByTagName just gets elements that have the tag name as you've specified. Keep in mind that ID is sort of what you specify. So when you say ID equals foobar, that's the ID that it gets. But tag name is the name of the tag itself. So img, for instance, image tag, or body, just body. And so on. So it says first get all those elements. And there's another difference is that ID is unique. So there's only one element with that ID. But here, elements, there can be multiple elements that have the sort of TR within this thing. So here, TR, it's what get elements by tag name returns as an array. So it basically says, give me back all the elements that have the TR tag. And once you have it, iterate over it. So this is just a for loop, if you're familiar with C or PHP, really. Excuse me. You're just setting, you have a counter variable that you're setting to zero. You're iterating over it. And when you iterate over it, you're saying if counter percent 2. So counter percent 2 basically says if counter is even. So if counter percent 2 equals 0, so if this is not true, what you do, so this is again something that sort of is the same idea in PHP, but when you have an if condition, you basically need this to not be 0 or false. So here it says if counter percent 2. So if counter is odd, counter percent 2, which is just counter reminder, the reminder of when you divide counter by 2 will be 1. So if it's odd, that is if that is not 0, just set the background to whatever color we specified here. So let's just try it out again and there we go. So for the first one, counter is 0, so when it gets the first row, the counter is 0. That one's false, so it does not change anything there. The next one, counter is 1, so that happens. Now we're going to, and for the third one, again, 3% 2, 3, the reminder of 3 when you divide 2 is not 0, so it changes the color there again. Questions?
There's no race condition since your function was below what it was called. It's just like a regular object-oriented programming language?
Yes. I'm not sure what you mean by race conditions, though.
I mean, in the sense that the function is called...
before where it was declared? Yes. I think JavaScript takes care of that. So the question was, does it matter that the function highlight table was called before where it was declared? JavaScript takes care of that. So far, clear? Sort of, just want you to get a feel for what is capable so that you can implement when you validate items in your own... In your own projects, it makes things easier.
So we're using straight JavaScript in these examples, right? We're going straight to the DOM,
mm-hmm.
and we're saying what's the specific ID, what's the class, what's
yep.
what's the element, what's the
yep.
tag, pulling it back, and
yep.
saying here's some array, do something.
Yep. So I'm just going to repeat that just because that was a great summary of what you need to do. You want to take a look at your document, pull out elements as you like. So either using ID or just like by specifying the name or such. Once you get through it, you either get an array or the actual element back. And once you have them back, you just make a bunch of changes, depending on certain other values, and then you just return from the function. That's like an overall sort of summary of what you want to do. So I have more validation examples clearly, and I think our time better spent by going over some of the project specific issues and then coming back to this if we have time at the end. Does that sound reasonable? So let's start with the let me erase all this. This is sort of a walkthrough for the project, sort of high level what you want to do, how you want to do. Let's begin by outlining the important, if you either want to read it off or just like tell me sort of conceptually what are the requirements of the project. Just high level sort of ideas, enable people to buy stocks, for instance. So buy stocks. So while selling, as a spec notes, you don't have to sell a specific number. You can just have them sell the entire thing. So I'm going to say sell all. Right. So sell all, that sort of implies that you're maintaining a portfolio, which is exactly the approach that you want to take.
It also implies that you actually have an account and that you
actually register. Right. So the question, right. So this implies that, actually, put that down here. This implies that you're registered and have an account. So you want to check the money. You want to make sure they have money to buy, how many ever stocks they want to buy, et cetera, et cetera. Any other thing?
Discover, you know, to make a decision.
Sure. So basically just let them know, basically display every all the information that they need in order for them to sort of link to these pages and buy.
Go to, it's not just buy a million shares of Google, it's give me information about it.
Sure. So you wanna present well, so this sort of falls into buying stocks, but details of a specific stock that they pick. Okay, so sort of high level of what we want to do. Let's begin with the register sort of account part. So I'm sure you've all gotten started on it, and if you haven't, it's you have time, but you really should get started soon. So with the register accounts, we did a little bit of registration last week. We talked specifically about this issue. So what do you need in terms of your database? So sort of like model.
You need a users table.
So if we find another color. So you need a users table, okay. And what should this contain?
Email address.
So email, username, password, etc.
Actually, the email address, from what I understand.
Okay, I'm not entirely sure, but that's entirely possible. So,
okay.
I think that's actually open to interpretation.
Okay, so that's okay. Yeah. So, regardless of which route you want to go, it sounds like it's fine. But I would check with the spec for that. Okay, so you have these are the.
You also want to put your total.
I'm sorry.
You want to put your total cash in there.
Exactly. So the other thing that you want in here is how much money you have left, right? And you initialize the person's account with $10,000, as $10,000 as indicated by the spec. So this is sort of what you want here. So how does registration happen? It's the same model we've seen before. There's a form. People fill out a bunch of details. You take the other form and you start with you submit it to a different PHP page. You look at the details that's submitted. Make sure they're all valid, and also perform validation with JavaScript in the first place. If they're all valid, just update this users table. So just like insert a row into that. Is that clear?
You may also want an account number.
Sure, you may. Right. So once again, this design is just to give you a base to work off with. So you might want to add other fields to this. You might want to not use. You might want to use the email as the username, and it's completely fine. Okay, so that's that. So let's talk a little bit about the details, sort of details of stocks. Details of stock. Okay, so what do we need, just like we talked about, for the registration and the... So when you log in, what do? You just have to check to see if the information that they gave you is valid in the database and it actually exists. And if it exists, that's what you want to use. So that's login, and if they're valid, just like we did at the beginning of PHP, sort of the whole authentication, set a session bit to true, indicate that they're authenticated, and then let them browse their account. Okay, so details of stock. So what do we need here?
The last trade seems to be the most relevant thing. I
mean, I'm sorry?
From the Yahoo perspective, we need to be able to get to the price of a stock.
Sure, so you need to be able to get to the price of a stock, which means you need... I'm sorry?
You need the symbol.
Right, so you need first a form, right? Because you're not specifying the symbol beforehand. So you need a form, and this form will submit to another PHP file. And this PHP, or itself, as we've gone over, and this should basically query Yahoo, the stock URL that we just did. So the example from the section should be pretty much all you need there. Get the information and sort of present it within a table or however you might choose to do. So once you have that, you want to actually have them enable them to like buy and sell stocks. So how would you go about that? So what do you need again for that? So let's say to buy stocks.
Well, I mean, once again, you're going to need a symbol, you're going to need the price, and you're going to need the form that allows you to purchase.
Right. So a symbol, a price, and whatever it allows you to purchase. So you have a form that accepts a quantity and a symbol name, right? Because you're letting them buy more than possibly one stock of Google, for instance. So you get a quantity and a symbol. Once you have those, you have to actually when they submit to a form, you need to use the symbol to get prize, because you wanna look up Yahoo's latest prices. They have to be real time, so it's possible it changed. So just look it up again, and get the price of the symbol that they requested. And now what do you do? So now what are the sort of like things that you need to update, things you need to set? Right. So the first thing you need to do is check that this field has enough money for their specific account. So somehow you have to keep track of their user ID, right? So when they log in, you need to sort of store that somewhere. And keep in mind that like every time you have to check, for instance, how much money they have, it's for that user ID that you initialized at the beginning. So take a look at their users table, see how much money they have, and then if they have enough money, what do you do? Right, so execute the purchase. So what does this require? This requires an additional
calculation,
but it also requires you need to store the actual purchase somewhere, right?
Right.
So you need a right. You need a table. So now this is where like you can sort of take many different approaches to this. So one way to do it is to just store all anytime anybody buys a purchase, anybody like purchases a stock, just store it in this table called sort of, I don't know, history or transaction or whatever you want. And just associate their purchases with the user ID. So that every time you have to look up, you just have to look through it and see if it has been bought or not. So this is one approach that you could take, and that's entirely fine. So in that case, you would just take, you also need to keep track of what the price was when they bought it. Because you don't necessarily need that. You just have to update the amount of money they have. So once they actually complete, so if they have enough money, you sort of store that transaction in somewhere in some table, and then update this field to make sure that their money is reduced accordingly.
The other thing you need to look at is if they've already bought this symbol. I mean, you don't want to create a new insert. You need to update the
right. So the comment was that if they've already bought it, you want to update it, and they're.
What if they bought it at a different price?
Right. That's exactly what I was going to say. So the question was, what if they bought it at a different price? So you have to keep in mind that you don't have to track how much they bought it for,
right.
Because all you need to update is this, because when you sell it, you're going to sell it at the price of that time.
Right. So as long as you're keeping track of what the total.
Right. As long as you're keeping track of the total users total, you're all set.
Really, all you need is the number of shares.
Yep. Exactly. So once you have the number of shares, when you sell, you can just once again look up the price of that time whenever they're selling it. And enable them to sort of sell that. So first you have to check to make sure there's no. But again, there are many different ways you can implement this, and not all of them sort of take the same approach. And any of them is fine as long as it's like thought out and well sort of explained. So you look at this table. You just say, oh, has user ID X bought stock Y? And if that's the case, you just increment the quantity that they buy now. If not, you insert a new row into this table. And once that's done, so that's the buying part of it. I'm sure there are details that I'm missing out, so just test your code, because we will try to break it. So just make sure you test your code in many different ways. And if that works out, you want to now actually enable them to sell it. So for them to sell it, the first thing they need to be able to do is view the stocks, right? They view the stocks that they own. How will you get that? You just have to look through this table that wherever you stored the buy. Just look for all the stocks that have their user ID in it. So just say, give me all the rows in this table that were purchased by user ID X. And if it exists in that table, you know that the stock exists, it's not been sold yet, and that like you know the quantity from that row. So once you have that, you just have to display each of them and then enable them to sell it. So what does selling entail? I'm sorry?
Money.
So the first thing you need to do, you have a form that lets them sort of submit the name of the symbol. So the first thing you need to do is to check if they actually own it, right? So if I don't own any Google shares, but I'm trying to sell Google shares, it doesn't make sense. So check to see if you can sell. If you can sell, once again, get the price, because the selling price of that time. So you basically have to query Yahoo again, and once you query Yahoo, you get back the price, you update this, and then you update the table of all your stocks. So you say, this person has sold it. So I'm going to delete this record and say sold. And once you're done with all that, the portfolio becomes very trivial, right? All you have to do for the portfolio is to remove the last functionality, i.e. selling of the stock. Once you have like this built in, all you need to do for the portfolio is select all records that belong to user ID X based on whatever they logged in with. And once you have that, you can just display them without any sort of functionality to sell things.
Table with the cell next to each
one. Sure, design is entirely up to you. Like, we want to leave this to your own interpretation. How pretty you want to make it is up to you. Sort of what you want to display is completely up to you. So, so I have one comment to make about the sort of when you're designing this product thing to keep in mind. So if you look at some of the operations here, you're doing them multiple times. So for instance, when to get the price of a stock, for instance, you're doing this several times, right? So you're querying Yahoo when you're buying it, you're querying Yahoo when you're selling it, and even in the portfolio, you're querying Yahoo because you want to check for that price and that time. So it probably makes sense, and this is a very good way to think about good design and good design for your code, to sort of abstract this into a function. So basically say, I'm going to give you, so have the function take an argument that is a symbol name, and have the function query Yahoo and return the price of the stock. So once you have this, every time you need a price, you don't have to like copy code again. It's just a question of calling the function. Keep in mind that there are many different ways you can sort of model the data and sort of model your code. So whenever you see repeated sort of code use, abstract things out and start using it.
So what do? You put it in a so-called include file, or what?
So the question is, do you put in an include file? That's exactly what you do. So you have an include file. You define the functions there. For instance, when we were working with SQL, for instance, what we did was we had an include file that made the connection to the table to the database for us, so that every time we needed it, we just like included the file. In very much the same way, just have an include file that defines these functions, so you can just access them by calling the function that's defined in there.
But what is the exact language?
I believe there are two things you can do. One is require once, and one is include. Let's just, there we go. So require once. Okay, so right. So require once basically makes sure that like when you require a file, you don't require it multiple times. Include is a similar. I'm not sure what the difference is, but these are the two sort of functions that you want to call when you want to.
David mentioned it.
Okay. Okay. So the comment was that it's about error handling, and that's looking up the documentation should give you enough information about that.
Now, if that's in a separate INC file,
mm-hmm.
you have quotation marks / INC, then the name of the function.
Yep. Just the file. So keep in mind that there's the requires apply to the requirement of, like the entire file. So it takes an argument of file name. Not a specific function, so it basically requires the entire file, and that's all you need.
So from an infrastructure perspective, I mean, should our code be creating the tables on the fly? Should we be creating the database on the fly? There's nothing in the spec file.
Sure, so the question was in terms of like sort of what your code should do with the database. Should it handle creation of table, like deletion of table, like I guess not deletion, but creating of the database, et cetera. You can never create a database, I believe. I'm not sure, but you like just for now, work like when you begin, just work with a created table from phpMyAdmin. But once you're done, if you have enough time, feel free to at the very beginning sort of go ahead and create the tables for the user.
Yeah, it seems like it's an easy thing to throw in with you.
Right. So it's entirely possible. You just have to make sure, just check to see the table does not already exist, right? Because
if
the table
exists.
Right, exactly. So creative not exists is exactly what you want. So once you just check, that's something that you could definitely do, but it's not required. And the reason the spec does not specify this is because we want to let people do whatever they sort of think is the right way. Any other questions? Okay.
Yeah, I do.
Sorry. No worries.
Now, we've been talking about PHP, now we talk about JavaScript. Are there ways for them to exchange information?
So the question was, are there ways for PHP and JavaScript to exchange information? Yes. So keep in mind that PHP can do, PHP sort of created HTML for us in a way, right? So we had HTML, And we had PHP sort of interjecting variable values and other computational values in it. Because my HTML is just markup. It cannot do sort of addition, right? So, and that's possible with JavaScript too. So you could say something like get element by ID and then open the PHP sort of tag and say echo a certain value. And that will work too, because it's just constructing along with the HTML will also construct the JavaScript, so to speak.
But what about the other direction?
The other direction, yes, it is also possible, but you will do a lot of that in Project 3. So right. So it's possible to sort of make requests to a page, like have the page like return value, like a PHP page from JavaScript, all that is possible. But okay. And this is something we'll do a lot of in Project 3. Okay. Any other questions? So that should give you an overall view. I really don't have much else to add. I saw this and figured, here we go. So I saw this and figured it would be a good way to end section. Last week we talked about SQL injection and how you can use sort of inject SQL into people's sort of submission values and do arbitrary things with your databases. And this is an XKCD comic on how a kid named Robert dropped table students because the input was not sanitized, ended up dropping a table in a database. If you have any questions, do email in at help@cs75.net. Thank you for coming, and I'll see you next week. Okay.